Well, welcome to this first Faculty AD seminar of 2004. It was great. Bob was very keen to do a seminar this year. So I think if we just speak in, we have the format we've been adopting over the last two. For those of you who haven't been here for those, Bob will speak for about 20, 25 minutes. And then there'll be, if anyone has any points of clarification, he's very happy to take those then. Then Bernard will respond first, and then Meg. And again, if there's any particular points of clarification that are necessary there. And after that, we'll give Bob a chance to respond to Meg and Bernard and throw it open to the floor.
Okay, thank you. I should explain the recording. It's a function of the policy that we set at the Lonergan Research Institute to record as many discussions around our work as possible, because we have an archive over there. And so all of our Lonergan seminars are recorded, and I thought that we should record this as well, so that for the sake of keeping a history of the Institute and its events, there will be a recorded history of the various discussions that have been prompted by the work that's being done at the Institute. So that's the reason for this. It's part of a general policy on the part of the Institute to record discussions. And I checked with both Meg and Bernard, and they were very graciously agreed that it was acceptable to them to record the discussion. I chose to present this paper here, however, rather than at a Lonergan Research. Oh, on the recording. After the my presentation and the responses and so on, we'll take about a 30-second interlude so that Greg can change the disc in the mini disc recorder for the discussion. So I chose to present this paper here rather than at a Lonergan seminar for two reasons. First of all, the issues that the paper addresses are in continuity with the issues that were raised in Meg Lavin's paper last spring. And that paper generated a great deal of fruitful discussion, and so I wanted to continue that discussion with the material that is presented in this paper. Secondly, this paper is not just on Lonergan. It attempts to integrate the Lonergan background from which I speak with the linguistic and hermeneutical backgrounds that may be more congenial to some of you and might be represented in the work that some of you are doing. So the paper is an ironic reaching out for peace with positions that more often than not are placed in contrariety with Lonergan's. And I'm saying I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. My presentation is divided into three sections. First of all, there's the philosophical issue. Secondly, there is one theological application that I'm going to speak to here. There are several that are made in the paper. And thirdly, there's the question of the location of truth. So first of all, the philosophical issue. In Lonergan's thought, as you probably all know, and you can use these diagrams to follow me here, everything turns on an intentionality analysis that distinguishes four levels of intentional consciousness. And that's 1, 2, 3, 4 in the middle column there. Experience, understanding, judgment, and decision, or empirical consciousness, intelligent consciousness, rational consciousness, and existential consciousness. My primary concern in the paper is with the levels of experience, 1, and understanding, 2. In the usual presentation of Lonergan's thought, experience or empirical consciousness, or 1, is used to refer to the presentation of immediate data of sense and of consciousness. And so it includes sounds, colors, tastes, smells, textures, images, and the self-presence of the subject in whatever he or she is doing, the data of consciousness, the immediate self-presence. These data may give rise to questions for intelligence, and the questions may spark original insights, and the insights will be expressed in conceptualizations, formulations, objectifications, hypotheses, theories, and so on. Now, what I'm suggesting in the paper is that we expand one, level one. Expand the standard conception that is usual in the Lonergan community of the first or empirical level of consciousness so that it includes not only colors, sounds, tastes, and so on and so forth, but also received meanings and values. Just think of, ask yourself the question as you're listening to me today, what is it to be born into and reared in a cultural and religious heritage? Before I ask questions about it, before I make it my own, before I try for original insight into it, before I question it, before I challenge it, perhaps. And that's what I'm talking about. So the received meanings and values that are handed on to me prior to any investigation that is done by me as a subject. And I think if we can include that, that's why on this outline I have Verstehen question mark. Heidegger's Verstehen is what I'm referring to there. All right? Understanding, but it's not understanding in the sense of original insight. He doesn't mean that. He means something else. He means an intellectually, intelligently apprehensive component at the very level of the reception of data. Now I think if we can include that there, then we can make peace, if you want, with what is salutary in Heidegger's Being and Time, and a lot is, with Wittgenstein's insistence on the public meaningfulness of ordinary language, and in Hans-Urs von Balthasar's taking to be true, wahrnehmen, the received forms that are expressions of God's revelation. And we take them to be true. And as children and as adults, you have taken many things to be true before you've ever subjected them to personal investigation, questioning, inquiry, and so on. Okay. These questions arose for me from being exposed to a paper by Sean McGraw. It looks like McGrath, but he pronounces it McGraw, at a seminar conducted in April 2003. So we're into the philosophical now, philosophical issues. At the seminar last April, the Lonergan Research Institute. There is a link, McGraw argues, and this is based on his dissertation, which he had just completed, from Scotus's, Duns Scotus's, Intuition of the Singular. Again, we're talking about this first level here. Intuition of the Singular is first level stuff. There's a link from that through Husserl's categorical intuition, an intuition that is informed by more than sense. It's informed by intellectual categories. To Heidegger's hermeneutical intuition, Verstehen, of the preconceptual forms of meaning to be found in historical life itself. There is an intelligent grasp at this level of received meaning for Heidegger. For each of those figures, Scotus, Husserl, Heidegger, knowledge is primarily intuition. The first level in Lonergan's schema would be the most important for all three of us. But for Heidegger, the intuition is not without expression. Not without language, not without some kind of articulation or embodiment in the carriers of meaning. Language for Heidegger means more than simply speech, although it does mean primarily speech. But he also means art, spontaneous intersubjectivity, symbols, the incarnate meaning of persons, communities, and their deeds, all of those carriers of meaning. Primal truth, aletheia, unconcealment, occurs for Heidegger only within such expressiveness at this level. But it never occurs as unmediated immediacy. Everything at this level is mediated symbolically, mediated linguistically, mediated artistically, mediated incarnately, however the mediation occurs. He says, and I think he's absolutely right, we have almost no access to experience that is not permeated by language in this broad sense. And so for Heidegger, what he calls hermeneutical phenomenology, which is one way in which he described his work at least at one point in his history, his career, hermeneutical phenomenology must loosen up the primal words in which life expresses itself so as to open a free space for thinking. That's the way he conceived what he was doing, loosening up the primal words through which life expresses itself. For Heidegger, as McGraw interpreted him in that paper, there's an actually intelligible thing, individual, occurrence, whatever, irreplaceable that is grasped by intelligently, by verstehen, by understanding, prior to any original cognitive processing on the part of the understanding subject. So it's not just that I hear a sound and say, what is that? But that I can receive a meaning and then question it. But I, when I receive it as meaning, I'm already, there's an understanding that's involved there. The historically singularized thing or individual or occurrence or statement speaks a primal word to us that precedes and makes possible our own inner word that proceeds from our own insights once we've asked questions about it. And that's what the way Heidegger understands history. That history is these words that first of all come to us and are received before they get processed and moved on by our own. Okay, so the position that I'm arguing in the paper is that in Lonergan you've got notions of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning that are referring, I think, to the same given intelligibility that Heidegger is talking about when he speaks of primarily intelligible structures at this level of perception. And I relate those same notions to Lonergan's distinction of the ordinary meaningfulness of everyday language, Wittgenstein's emphasis, and the original meaningfulness of language that expresses new discoveries. If you have a significant new discovery, you also have to have new words. You've got to have a new way of talking about it. Original meaningfulness. And in that sense, I'm trying to link Heidegger, Lonergan, and Wittgenstein. And I argue that these links do not subvert any of them, any of those three, but rather reinforce the contributions that they're making. All right, so first of all, elemental meaning, the category of elemental meaning. What does Lonergan mean by elemental meaning? Well, again, if you look at this from here. Elemental meaning for Lonergan obtains whenever the subject and the object are not distinct. There's an original identity of knower and known. Sense in act, Aristotle had this, over against Plato. Sense in act is the sensible in act. There is no actual sound if there isn't an ear to hear it. There only there's potential sound because there are sound waves in the air. But there's not actual sound unless there's an actual ear to hear it. Sense in act and sensible in act are identical. All right, so this whole first level is elemental meaning. But also with Lonergan, insight. The one component of the second level is elemental meaning. When you've had an insight, an original insight, you are one with that. Knower and known are identical. The distinction occurs only when you start thinking in order to express it. And then the distinction, you become distinct from it. There's a distinction that occurs with conceptualization, formulation, objectification. So elemental meaning refers, in Lonergan, to sense and to insight, the first act, as it were, of the second level of consciousness understanding. Now, what I'm asking is a further question. Can we speak of an elemental identity of knower and known at this first level, but that because it occurs in an act like verstehen, understanding, a kind of understanding, is not just sense in act and sensible in act, but also because it's not a matter of original insight, which is what Lonergan's talking about, arising as a release to the tension of my own questions, it's not at this level, the second level, it's rather down here, that at the level of receiving data, there is an understanding that takes place as meaningful data are passed on to me. As I learn my cultural and religious heritage and tradition, for instance, and it's passed on to me, and I just, for a long time in my life, I just accept it and live with it, okay, before I've ever questioned it. Okay. Is there some kind of identity of intellect and act and intelligible and act in the very reception of meaningful data on the part of a subject who is intelligent and who can be reasonable and responsible? Isn't this what happens when we absorb our cultural and religious heritage before we question it? And before we either make it our own or try to develop it or try to change it or reject it? Isn't this what happens? Is that it simply is received, but it's a set of meanings and values that's received, not just colors and tastes and sounds and textures and so on. All right. The question was put to me by Sean McGraw in email interchanges. Is there, this is using Thomas language now, is there some kind of lesser illuminatio that occurs prior to insight into phantasm, which is would then be a major illumination, but is there some kind of lesser illumination that's prior to that in human beings? So, and some of the evidence is in Lonergan, the elemental meaning of the smile before it's analyzed. You walk into somebody's room and you can tell by a look in the face, there's an intersubjective determinant. If they're smiling gently, you're welcome. If there's a scowl, you better come back later. There's elemental meaning being communicated through that is received as meaning. Okay, it's received as meaning. He speaks of the elemental meaning of the work of art before it is interpreted by a critic. Before a critic has gone to work at these levels, okay, intelligent, reasonable, and maybe responsible. Uh-huh. Before that, there's an elemental meaning to it. He speaks of the elemental meaning of the dream symbol effecting internal communication between body, spirit, and psyche before it's ever subjected to interpretation by an analyst or a therapist or whatever. And I'm just asking, isn't there something true of many of the received data? Many of the data that we receive are already invested with a meaning that is a function of history, of their historical facticity, of personal and communal history. And that meaning is not merely potential. And in order to express the fact that it's not merely potential, that's why I have the expression in there of a minor formal and actual intelligibility. Major, these are categories out of Lonergan. Formal intelligibility is second level intelligibility, all right? It's conceptualization. Actual intelligibility is the intelligibility that's affirmed in judgment. But can you speak of maybe a minor formal and actual intelligibility in the received data? Formal in the sense of verstehen, there's an understanding there. Actual in the sense that you accept it before you've really subjected it to criticism. So there's an empirical givenness of meaningfulness and possibly truth at that level. All right. So that's the philosophical issue. One further way of explaining it a little bit more, expressing it. Being born and raised in a Christian family, for instance. I just take that as an example. There are received meanings that function effectively and constitutively in your development before you've ever really subjected them to any kind of inquiry and investigation, before they've been subjected to any critical examination of personal and communal appropriation. They possess an intelligibility that is not just potential. It's constitutive of you, it's constitutive of your family, it's constitutive of your environment. But it's not yet yours in the sense that you've really made it your own. And many people in terms of faith development will talk about certain things that have to happen before it's really made your own. But it's there. It's informing you. It's received meaning. But it's ordinary meaningfulness. It's public language. But that public language, that ordinary meaningfulness, is a function of the original acts of meaning of the people who handed it on to you. Original acts of meaning on the part of the insights, the judgments, the decisions of people who have preceded you, or perhaps of their biases and their blind spots, or maybe of some combination of the two. And when you come to investigate it yourself, that's what you've got to ask. All right, about that original meaningfulness that handed this on to you, was it authentic or not? That's a major question that I suggest in the paper is perhaps one of the most wrenching questions that we can ask in our lives. Am I living? Is the tradition that I've been taught to live by authentic or inauthentic? A very important question we've all got to ask at some point. But before that, you're living by it. And that's what I'm getting at. Okay. That's enough. So let me just do this. Lonergan on ordinary meaningfulness and original meaningfulness. This is a quotation from Method and Theology 255, 256. The ordinary meaningfulness of ordinary language is essentially public and only derivatively private. It's public and it's come to us from the public, from the community. It's the language of the community. It's the language that the community uses. What is true of the ordinary meaningfulness of ordinary language, he says, is not true of the original meaningfulness of any language, ordinary, literary, or technical. For all language develops, and at any time, any language consists in the sedimentation of the developments that have occurred and have not become obsolete. Developments consist in discovering new uses for existing words, inventing new words, diffusing the discoveries and inventions. And that's a matter of original meaningfulness. So there's ordinary meaningfulness, and then there's the original meaningfulness to express new insights and so on and so forth. Okay, that's the philosophical issue. The one theological application that I want to do is the one on revelation and reception. So if you've got the paper, I'm not sure the page on revelation and reception.
26.
God's revelation is a matter of meaning. It's God's entering into the world of human meaning. Now, meaning has four functions, and God's meaning performs all four of these functions. Meaning is cognitive. So there's something that we come to know because of revelation. Meaning is constitutive. It constitutes part of the reality of the people who receive revelation. God's revelation has meaning. Constitutes our reality. It changes our horizon and so on. It changes our values. So it's constitutive in that sense. It's communicative because it induces in us some share in God's meaning, in God's own meaning, in the meaning that God shares, that three persons share with one another in the Trinity. And it's effective because it persuades or commands or induces or invites, or sometimes the Bible even uses seduces. God seduces us. I was seduced, says Jeremiah, and he's complaining about it. You seduced me, and now look at me, I'm in jail. Okay. So these aspects of meaning, cognitive, constitutive, effective, communicative, pertain to meaning at any stage of cultural development. And at any stage of consciousness, differentiation of consciousness. And in the presence and absence of conversion, meaning has these functions. And also, no matter what the carrier might be, whether it's in your subjectivity, art, symbol, personal conduct, everyday, literary, technical language. Now, you've got the community and you've got the individual. And Lonergan says there's a relative dominance of the community over the individual. And what he means by this is that the horizon of the subject in the world, and the world that's correlative to my horizon, prior to any critical reflection on my part, is largely a function of what the community has given me. It's largely a function of being thrown into the world, in Heidegger's terms, at this time, with this family, and this time and place, with this religious community, or with this lack of religious community, or whatever. It's largely a function of Heidegger's temporal and historical facticity that I can't do anything about. I can't determine into what family I'm going to be born, or I was born, just here. Okay, so I got to start with that. I can do something about that, but I can't change that. So with these particular people, all right, but their horizons were similarly determined and limited for them by historical dialectical situations over which they had no control. So that's what he means. The community has a relative dominance. But only relative, because once I begin to appropriate it and make it my own, I can do something about it. It no longer has to have that dominance. I can make it my own and pass it on, or I can change it, modify it, reject it, challenge it, whatever. Okay. So the very reception of data invested in meaning constitutes my horizon. Now, I think it's precisely at that level of primordial receptivity that God's entrance through revelation into the world of human meaning takes place. God's entry into the world of human meaning is at the level of elemental meaning. I'm not saying this on my own. Avery Dulles says it in his book, Models of Revelation, when he, in one chapter, moves away from models and gives his own position. Revelation is God's symbolic communication. That's elemental meaning. God communicates symbolically, originally through symbolic communication. So it's at the level of elemental meaning, it's at the level of the changes, at this level of primal reception, that God enters the world of human meaning. And that changes everything, okay? correlative to our horizons. In doing so, God enters cognitively, constitutively, communicatively, effectively through a word that God speaks to us, and ultimately a word that God becomes in our history, the incarnate word, the Son of the Eternal Father, crucified, dead, and risen from the dead. Now, the formal constituent of the community that has this relative dominance over the subject, the formal constituent is the community's common meaning. So I'm born into a family, let's say the family is very religious, it's Catholic, all right, there's the common meaning of the church that is is a big part of the community that I'm born into. That common meaning is constitutive of me as a member of this community, it's constitutive of the community itself. And its genesis occurs through an ongoing process of communication. People share the same cognitive, constitutive, and effective meanings with one another. That's how the community functions. And the really serious divisions in the community, for Lonergan, are those that would arise not from some people being less developed than others, but from the presence and absence of the conversions that render people genuine, intellectual, moral, religious, and I would add psychic, and my whole paper is about the development of psychic conversion. Because then you've got a radical dialectical opposition that can affect the community and tear it apart if healing doesn't take place. The state of the community affects the receptivity of both individuals and groups. So the state of the community, if my family is happy and happy with their religion and so on, it changes my receptivity to God's revelation. It affects it. God's entry into the world of human meaning through God's symbolic self-communication. There's a very radical statement in the final chapter of De Deo Trino, and it's still in Latin, and maybe in English soon. Lonergan distinguishes the habit of grace, which is an individual thing, from the state of grace. The state of grace is a social reality. The state of grace is an intersubjective reality. It's a communion of the three divine subjects with a community of human subjects. And so you're born into a community that is relatively in the state of grace, if you want, and relatively, of course, every community is also relatively affected by bias. But what I'm saying is that the ordinary meaningfulness of the subject's everyday life is a function of what's operative in the community, and that ordinary meaningfulness may be more or less sinful and more or less under the influence of grace. Revelation as God's entrance into the human world of meaning shifts the probabilities in favor of a graced ordinary meaningfulness. And that shift in probabilities affects the potential of each of us as individuals to receive the divine meaning that God intended when God entered our world of meaning. I have one further point to make, and that's the question of the location of truth. So within this context, the question of truth emerges as the question of the validity or objectivity of the system of meanings and values by which the community and individuals within the community structure their lives. How can one tell, Lonergan asks in Religious Knowledge, a paper in the third collection, how can one tell whether one's appropriation of religion is genuine or unauthentic? And more radically, how can one tell one is not appropriating a religious tradition that has become unauthentic? Or as he says elsewhere, one can authentically realize and propagate inauthenticity. By being faithful to an inauthentic tradition, you are authentically propagating inauthenticity. How do you know you're not doing that? And that question can be generalized beyond religion to our cultural system, our political system, and so on. There may be no more significant question in the whole of human life than how can I tell whether the convictions that I've been taught to live by are a function of a tradition or set of traditions that have become unauthentic? How can I judge whether the ordinary meaningfulness that constitutes my present horizon is a function of an unauthentic or an authentic tradition? And that answer can be discovered only by the release of the original meaningfulness that is the criterion of only by the release of the original meaningfulness by which we submit our beliefs and convictions to an immanent critique in order to ascertain their genuineness. The self-transcendence that is the criterion of authenticity or genuineness that moves upward and subjects these to a radical investigation. Heidegger speaking mainly about the ordinary meaningfulness that constitutes present horizons. Lonergan is speaking about the original meaningfulness that submits ordinary meaningfulness to critique and probably to transformation. Healing and creating, that's original meaningfulness, healing and creating. So the operations that constitute original meaningfulness, insight, judgment, decision, alone are able to pass judgment on the truth of the ordinary meaningfulness of present horizons, provided those operations are conducted under God's grace. The imminently generated affirmations, imminently generated, that emanates from the grasp of the virtually unconditioned, including grasping that it is essential that I believe, that grasping the value of belief, that is capable of ascertaining the truth of the unconcealment, aletheia, at the first level. So what I'm saying is Heidegger's notion of truth as unconcealment at that first level, that alone will not do. That is not sufficient for truth. Because we can have a whole tradition unconcealed to us that can be an inauthentic tradition. And if anybody should know that, it was Heidegger, who for years came under the spell of Nazism. Right? Unconcealment, but unconcealment of evil. So that will not do, nor will von Balthasar's Wahrnehmen at that first level. You've got to go on from that. You've got to confirm it by some sort of process that leads these things to the point where they're your own. And that's what Lonergan's talking about. These other people are talking about receiving it. And that's a very important thing. Be attentive. That's Lonergan's be attentive. That's what they're talking about. That's fine. But there has to be more than that. So I'm saying that much, and I'm saying also that Heidegger's notion of truth is about something essential to this. While it's not completely adequate, it's essential. It's about the first transcendental precept, be attentive. Okay? Focus. Be attentive. That's what Heidegger's talking about. Insights are only as good as the images in which they grasp intelligibility. If we forget the images, that reduces and in the limit eliminates the probability that we're going to have the insights that we need, not only to get on with our individual lives, but also to fulfill our historical responsibilities, whether those are responsibilities to persons, families, partners, friends, communities, culture, history, the church, whatever. Insight into image, Lonergan says, is infallible. But if the images are distorted, the insights are going to be distorted as well. And until the forgetfulness of the data is overcome, and I think that's what these people are talking about, overcoming the forgetfulness of the data, the marshaling of evidence for a reasonable judgment will be lacking components. And that overcoming the forgetfulness of data is what psychic conversion is all about. Whether it's defined from below, this is my last statement, as the transformation of the censorship over neural demands from a repressive to a constructive functioning, or whether it's explained from above in language that appeals to healing, what Heidegger calls the forgetfulness of being. It's a transformation that effects a renewed link between the creative, inquiring human spirit moving up and the materials, the elemental meaning, the mediated immediacy that at any given time constitute the starting point of the creative process. Thanks.
Are there any questions of clarification, just points of clarification at this stage? No?
Maybe just one question.
Sure.
You're trying to posit this ordinary meaningfulness on this first level.
Yes.
What are the objections? What would the objections be?
The objections will come from people schooled in a particular reading of Lonergan.
Okay.
That the first level is colors, sounds, tastes, touch, textures, smells, and the self-presence, the immediate self-presence of consciousness. And I don't think, I go on in the paper that I read from today, this is a paper that I'm writing for a symposium in Los Angeles in April, I go on to find evidence and insight that he means more himself than that. But the common reading in the Lonergan community is that, and I think that that's a misreading. And I think that to talk about colors and so on for human beings is an abstraction for the most part. We have pure sensations very rarely. If you're walking down a flight of stairs and you're expecting that you're at the end and you've got one more to go, that's a pure sensation. It's outside the pattern. But otherwise, everything's patterned for us in some way, either sensitively or intelligently. So the objections would come, and that's if this were being read to... I was fearful last summer when I delivered this at the Lonergan Workshop in Boston. And actually, the reception was quite kind, and from some of the heavy hitters philosophically in the Lonergan community, so I was quite pleased. But I thought I was going to get one more rejection slip from the Lonergan community. I had one already with psychic conversion because a lot of them don't accept it. But this time it worked.
Husserl, was that you mentioned?
No. Husserl.
Yes.
Categorical intuition.
Intuition. What do you mean by categorical?
It's the same thing. It's similar to what I'm saying here, that our reception of data is already informed by meanings.
So a very general meaning, categorical, not philosophical categories.
No. He's talking about ordinary experience.
When you mentioned that the color is an abstraction, so what we first perceive then is objects that are colored, really concretely.
I didn't say color is an abstraction, Joe. I said that to think of what we receive at that first level as just colors and just sounds, that's an abstraction. We're abstracting the colors and the sounds.
Yeah,
when we
but
talk
what, you,
that way,
what you perceive is an object
something
that
much
appears
more
really under that particular...
Yeah. And that in many instances is meaningful.
Yeah.
And the meaning, the apprehension of meaning is at that original reception, the apprehension of meaning. So.
Thank you.
So, Bernard, would you like to respond first? Professor Doran's paper reminds me of two events. And perhaps not by chance, both happened during lectures of two different courses on Bernard Lonergan, part of my initiation into his world and works. The first was in the course Method in Theology. And the subject matter was history, the third functional specialty. And someone asked the question, what has history to do with theology? It seemed to me like a subtle statement. History does not have anything to do with theology. At least that's how I perceived or interpreted. However, some concurred with the question or the statement, and a long discussion ensued. I must confess that the question and ensuing discussion surprised me. The second course was themes from Lonergan's philosophy. I was trying to understand Lonergan's empirical consciousness as the experience of data of sense and the data of consciousness. As a child learning how to make sounds, I vaguely, at least to myself, try to articulate a question. Do I experience data as raw data, or is there already some interpretation as I receive data due to my own tradition, history, and the tradition and history within which data itself is presented to me? Thus, I welcome Professor Doran's paper approximately as assisting me to articulate my own question and proceed toward an understanding of Lonergan's notion of experience and empirical consciousness. On the question of history, I'm using the word history in a broader sense, or the word of tradition and community, all of which I think constitutes the movement from above, Professor Doran cautions. But Lonergan students should take care not so to stress the interior operations that give rise to original meaningfulness as to pass over in silence or even denial the fact that ordinarily, that is, in ordinary meaningfulness of everyday life, we start from publicly sedimented expressions already invested with meaning. That's page 23 and 24 of the text. In addition, at the end of the paper, Professor Doran suggests what Lonergan is promoting, healing the forgetfulness of an already given temporally and historically conditioned facticity that is mediated by meaning as a starting point for the exercise of the operations by which original meaningfulness creates. It's page 27. So that's what history has got to do with theology, I think. My own attempt in understanding what Professor Doran proposes of elemental meaning or mediated immediacy that is received in and through empirical consciousness or experience is grasped with an analogy of the relationship between the child and his or her mother. After all, Wittgenstein abandoned philosophy temporarily to teach in a kindergarten, to children definitely, probably even to learn from them. It seems that even prior to the child's first inner word, mother, prescinding from the child's first utterance of the word mother, there is already a meaning mother. The newborn child knows his or her mother. Only the mother, known to the child, seems to be able to provide for the child in need of food, etc. The ceaseless cries of the child are silenced by the smile, presence, and embrace of the mother. And I'm pressed to ask, from where does the child receive this knowledge, however rudimentary it may be, or receive this meaning as elemental? There seems to be an effective or emotional acknowledgement or knowledge that the child possesses, meanings and values in his or her spontaneous intersubjectivity with the mother. Could it be because the materials that emerge in consciousness are already patterned, and the pattern is already charged emotionally and cognitively? Reference to page 4 and 5 of the text. Or is this what is referred to as the intuited is always already expressed, or the primal expression is an intuited domain of meaning, as McGrath interprets Heidegger, and still further on page 15, expressions which precede inner words. Perhaps the phenomenology of the child's consciousness could yield a better understanding. I leave this to those who are competent on this subject. This leads me to ask another question regarding the relationship of the present to the past in the context of making judgments, page 6 to 7. If the past judgments that remain with us involves consciously and or explicitly made judgments, is there another form of judgment made, and I suggest rudimentary, or perhaps even the minor formal or actual intelligibility, as in the case of a child's knowledge of his or her mother? And in addition, is this judgment conscious or unconscious? Finally, the intelligent component that is at work in the very reception of data is retrieved and released through psychic conversion, which re-establishes a link between the inquiring and critical spirit and the mediated immediacy of that empirical consciousness. How then is the retrieval of release itself, which is psychic conversion, is effected in the march towards original meaningfulness, faithful to the past, yet not stifled by it, especially by that which is not authentic in the culture and community, as Bob Doran adverted to it just now, the text on page 34. Further, what is the operator, or what is operative in this retrieval and release? And my last statement is a question asked by Michael Palarchik with regard to the objections of the Lonergan community regarding the work. So I'll just say that the paper itself promises some fruitful endeavor towards furthering what Lonergan himself may have expressed. Therefore, my question would be, what more could be done? Bob Doran again adverted to some more work in the text, Insight, as a furthering of this work. Thank you.
Does anybody have any points of clarification they wish to raise for Bernard? Gwen, Nick?
Thank you. There are, I think, three major issues in Professor Doran's paper that have encouraged me to reconsider. First of all, some of the things that I put forward in my thesis on Revelation and Wittgenstein's understanding of language. Or secondly, more specifically, to find out if there's anything in Wittgenstein's understanding of the ordinariness of everyday language that can relate to the Lonerganian notion of original meaningfulness. And third, a response to the notion of ordinary original meaningfulness of Professor Doran's paper, using some of the ideas in my previous paper that I presented here at the Faculty AD seminar on symbolic order and real symbol, which Professor Doran alluded to at the beginning. So for the purposes of our time here today, I'm going to focus on the third of these. And it's my hope at some sooner date, rather than some later date, to work on the first two. But to respond today, I'm going to pick up on the following from Doran's paper. Patterns of experience in which there is a prior collaboration of imagination and intelligence, and that the materials that emerge in consciousness are already patterned. And so this, Doran tells us, is what in the earlier Lonergan anticipated Lonergan's understanding of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning. Also, the dialectic of the community over the dialectic of the subject, with the obvious observation that the community precedes us. In the paper, we also, I think all of this comes together in what Lonergan calls ordinary meaningfulness. But somehow, though, there is an original meaningfulness, either outside or transcends or alongside this ordinary meaningfulness. And Doran also tells us that ordinary meaningfulness is related to language, which includes all carriers of meaning. But what is true of the ordinary meaningfulness of language is not true of the original meaningfulness of language, that somehow all language develops through finding new issues for existing words. So those are the issues that underpin the remarks that I am going to make. I'm not going to talk to each one of them in detail, but as I went through my remarks, those are the things that were the foundation for what I want to say. Doran proposed that Lonergan's contribution to this discussion is not simply to ordinary meaningfulness of Heidegger's historical facticity or to Wittgenstein's ordinary public language, both of which he accedes, but to the original meaningfulness that is responsible for healing and creating in history. Now, the two are interrelated for Lonergan. The original meaningfulness of one generation or of one period in a person's life becomes the ordinary meaningfulness of a later generation or even a later period in a person's life. I would like to suggest a movement that takes us deeper into this interrelatedness of the ordinary and the original. One which I think is linked to how Doran wants to expand his notion of psychic conversion. I believe, following Karl Rahner, that there is already within the human person as natural being a potent or receptive capacity for both ordinary and original meaningfulness. I accept the premise that culture precedes us. But what continues to grasp my attention, however, is if culture is so all-pervasive, how can we transcend culture? Or how do new meanings and new developments emerge? In my paper entitled Symbolic Order, a Hermeneutic for Sacramental Theology, I presented a comparison of symbolic order, an approach to sacramental theology by Louis-Marie Chauvet, which he bases on Heidegger's understanding of language and being, and of Karl Rahner's real symbol, which is based on an ontology that finds its source in a theology of the Trinity. The reason I embarked on this discussion was that one of the major concerns in sacramental theology today is symbolic competence, that is, the way in which symbols operate in our lives and how this relates to the responsible reception of the sacraments. It is my belief that these are related to the broader areas of language, reception, and empirical consciousness that Doran deals with in his paper. Using Doran's terms, I would say that Chauvet moves within the realm of ordinary meaningfulness, and Rahner more within the realm of original meaningfulness. Let me explain. The core of Chauvet's argument is that one cannot be a human being without language, and that we are brought into being by the linguistic and cultural structure that always precedes us. Following Heidegger, he believes that to say that human beings are constituted as subjects by language is also to say that every perception of the reality of subjects is mediated by their culture and their history, or in a coherent whole that Chauvet calls the symbolic order. Reality is never present to us except in a mediated way. It is constituted out of the symbolic network of culture which fashions us. In this symbolic order, agreement is always necessary. And so all of this, I believe, is in the realm of ordinary meaningfulness. Now for Rahner, symbol has to do with nature and meaning, and not only with language and culture. It is nature that is the permanent structure of being, insofar as nature is the principle and antecedent law of being's activity and not simply language. This nature of being is open in that it tends by the absolute transcendence of the intellect and the will to reality and thus to God. It can also objectify itself and make itself the object of its acts. In other words, it is personal and stands in a dialogical relationship with the absolute mysterious ground of all reality, that is, with God. And so this nature of being, then, is about who we are in relationship to God. The openness of the human subject also implies the God-given capacity for the divine self-communication of free grace. And this potency, Rahner calls receptivity. This receptivity has no advanced claim and remains always obedient to God's pleasure. Rahner summarizes, human nature is then, quote, an obediential receptivity for the radical self-expression of God, which is actualized in Jesus Christ, unquote. And so it is on this understanding of being that Rahner builds his ontology of real symbol. All beings are by their nature symbolic because they openly express themselves in order to attain their own nature. And so following from his model of the Trinity, he believes that all beings as symbolic expressions are multiple. Each finite being has within itself a real multiplicity, which is not merely a mental distinction of an external observer, but an inner self-realization. And in keeping with the theology of the reflections of an inner Trinitarian plurality, Rahner believes that it's quite thinkable that the pluralism of the finite being is not merely a consequence and indicator of its finiteness, but as a consequence of the divine plurality. And so each being in its own way somehow is something distinct from itself, as in the distinction of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and yet one in itself, as in the immanence of the Trinity. And so what we have then is a differentiated being, which in its originality is one. And I believe that it is because of this multiplicity and unity in one originality that we carry within us both the capacity for the ordinary meaningfulness that precedes us and an original meaningfulness that is part of the nature of our being that we bring with us. I do not believe that we are hurled into existence empty-handed. As the psalmist says to God, "It was you who created my inmost self who put me together in my mother's womb." And also, as Doran states, quote, on page 29, "God's entrance into the world of human meaning is God's effecting transformation in the already given intelligibility of the world that is correlative to our horizons, affecting transformations through the cognitive, constitutive, communicative, and effective functions of God's own meaning, of God's original meaningfulness," unquote. And so thus, yes, I would agree with Chauvet and Heidegger and Wittgenstein that we are born into the ordinary meaningfulness of a network of symbolic order. And in this order, we find our place and establish our identity. But culture was made for humanity. Humanity was not made for culture. There is no doubt that we are formed by language and culture, but this is only half of the story. It is the nature of the human person that is a presupposition of culture and not the other way around. Without beings, there would be no culture. We originate as being, we are not brought into being by language. I might concede that we develop as subjects or citizens of culture, but we originate in the symbolization of our being that is the inner realization which expresses itself in history, and in this origination we have a unique relationship with God. We are created in the Trinitarian image of God, and in this self-transcendence we are open, by our very nature, to God's self-communication of grace. This is our original meaningfulness. And so how can I transcend my culture? Or in Doran's words, how can I take a critical stance toward these systems? Or in his exact words, quote, "How can I judge whether the ordinary meaningfulness that constitutes my present horizon, historically and culturally conditioned as it is a function of the authentic or unauthentic tradition?" The answer, he says, can be discovered only by the release of the original meaningfulness by which we submit our beliefs and convictions to an immanent critique in order to ascertain their genuineness, unquote. And so I would like to add that this happens through the release of our God-given capacity for the divine self-communication of free grace in Revelation.
Thanks. Does anyone have any questions or points of clarification to make? Okay. Would you like to make a brief response to
Do you have time yet on the disc? Okay. Yeah, just very briefly. Thank you both. These are scattered comments in response to individual things that you've said. But interesting, on the child and the mother, Lonergan and von Balthasar agree. They both have made statements in print. Lonergan's was more a side comment, but it is published somewhere. The statement is to the effect it all begins in the mother's smile, you know. And the mother's smile is a meaningful gesture. And it's a communication. It's an intersubjective communication of meaning. But of course, the infant is not able to articulate or formulate or anything like that and say, "Thank you, Mommy, for smiling at me," or anything like that. But there is a communication there, an intersubjective communication. Lonergan's got a long thing that he repeats in a number of things of the phenomenology of the smile. And the different smiles, and some smiles are sardonic and sarcastic, and others are welcoming, and so on and so forth. And they are communications of meaning. Meg's comment, and there was one question that the two of you had in common, I'm going to come back to that. But I'm glad that you picked up on relating it to your paper of last year, because that's exactly what I was hoping would come out here, so that we could see a continuity. Discussion. I agree completely that what Chauvet was representing is to a large extent the ordinary meaningfulness and rather the original meaningfulness. And I have no questions at all about your use of Rahner's philosophy and theology, which is very germane in many respects to a lot of it anyway, but for what you're saying about the original meaningfulness. The only point that I would want to make is that I think the release, and this is the question that was raised by both of you, how is a release possible when the culture and the community are inauthentic, or as Lonergan says in the introduction to Insight, when the whole texture of a civilization is so governed by bias, and he's talking about the civilizations that most of us have grown up in and live in, how are we going to find release from this? Well, you know, how is the individual, it's a big question, and, you know, but how is the individual, I think the individual's release, while it is a function of divine grace, in every instance it is, but it's almost always mediated through the community, or through a person that loves them, or through an individual. We are carriers of the love of God, and the conduits of that. You know, we are that by God's gift to us. And I think that the release is through that. The danger is if anybody starts to take responsibility for actually doing that, you're in trouble, because then you've got exercising the power and that sort of thing that are completely illegitimate and could be idolatrous. But we have the occasions of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, where it was an individual immediately hit by lightning almost, you know. But most of the time, the healing or the conversion or whatever it is that has to take place is mediated through contact with another human being or a community or whatever. And I think the phenomenology of this has to include that aspect. All right, I think let's give Greg 30 seconds to change.